Listening Library presents Before I Fall by Lauren Oliver. Read by Sarah Drew.
Prologue. They say that just before you die, your whole life flashes before your eyes. But that's not how it happened for me. To be honest, I'd always thought the whole final moment, mental life scan thing sounded pretty awful. Some things are better left buried and forgotten, as my mom would say. I'd be happy to forget all of fifth grade, for example. The glasses and pink braces period. And does anybody want to relive the first day of middle school? Add in all of the boring family vacations, pointless algebra classes, period cramps, and bad kisses I barely lived through the first time around. The truth is, though, I wouldn't have minded reliving my greatest hits. When Rob Cochran and I first hooked up in the middle of the dance floor at homecoming so everyone saw and knew we were together. When Lindsay, Elodie, Allie, and I got drunk and tried to make snow angels in May, leaving person-sized imprints in Allie's lawn. My sweet 16 party, when we set out 100 tea lights and danced on the table in the backyard. The time Lindsay and I pranked Clara Seuss on Halloween, got chased by the cops, and laughed so hard we almost threw up. The things I wanted to remember, the things I wanted to be remembered for. But before I died, I didn't think of Rob, or any other guy. I didn't think of all the outrageous things I'd done with my friends. I didn't even think of my family, or the way the morning light turns the walls in my bedroom the color of cream. Or the way the azaleas outside my window smell in July, a mixture of honey and cinnamon. Instead, I thought of Vicky Hallinan. Specifically, I thought of the time in fourth grade when Lindsay announced in front of the whole gym class that she wouldn't have Vicky on her dodgeball team. "She's too fat," Lindsay blurted out. "You could hit her with your eyes closed." I wasn't friends with Lindsay yet, but even then, she had this way of saying things that made them hilarious, and I laughed along with everyone else while Vicky's face turned as purple as the underside of a storm cloud. That's what I remembered in that before-death instant, when I was supposed to be having some big revelation about my past. The smell of varnish and the squeak of our sneakers on the polished floor, the tightness of my polyester shorts, the laughter echoing around the big, empty space like there were way more than 25 people in the gym. And Vicky's face. The weird thing is that I hadn't thought about that in forever. It was one of those memories I didn't even know I remembered, if you know what I mean. It's not like Vicky was traumatized or anything. That's just the kind of thing that kids do to each other. It's no big deal. There's always going to be a person laughing and somebody getting laughed at. It happens every day, in every school, in every town in America, probably in the world, for all I know. The whole point of growing up is learning to stay on the laughing side. Vicky wasn't very fat to begin with. She just had some baby weight on her face and stomach. And before high school, she'd lost that and grown 3 inches. She even became friends with Lindsay. They played field hockey together and said hi in the halls. One time, our freshman year, Vicky brought it up at a party. We were all pretty tipsy, and we laughed and laughed, Vicky most of all, until her face turned almost as purple as it had all those years ago in the gym. That was weird thing number one. Even weirder than that was the fact that we'd all just been talking about it. How it would be just before you died, I mean. I don't remember exactly how it came up, except that Elodie was complaining that I always got shotgun and refusing to wear her seatbelt. She kept leaning forward into the front seat to scroll through Lindsay's iPod, even though I was supposed to have DJ privileges. I was trying to explain my greatest hits theory of death, and we were all picking out what those would be. Lindsay picked finding out that she got into Duke, obviously, and Allie, who was bitching about the cold, as usual, and threatening to drop dead right there of pneumonia, participated long enough to say she wished she could relive her first hookup with Matt Wilde forever, which surprised no one. Lindsay and Elodie were smoking, and freezing rain was coming in through the cracked open windows. The road was narrow and winding, and on either side of us, the dark, stripped branches of trees lashed back and forth like the wind had set them dancing. Elodie put on Splinter by Fallacy to piss Allie off, maybe because she was sick of her whining. It was Allie's song with Matt, who had dumped her in September. Allie called her a bitch and unbuckled her seatbelt, leaning forward and trying to grab the iPod. Lindsay complained that someone was elbowing her in the neck. The cigarette dropped from her mouth and landed between her thighs. She started cursing and trying to brush the embers off the seat cushion, and Elodie and Allie were still fighting, and I was trying to talk over them, reminding them all of the time we'd made snow angels in May. The tires skidded a little on the wet road, and the car was full of cigarette smoke, little wisps rising like phantoms in the air. Then, all of a sudden, there was a flash of white in front of the car. Lindsay yelled something, words I couldn't make out, something like sit, or shit, or sight. And suddenly the car was flipping off the road and into the black mouth of the woods. I heard a horrible screeching sound, metal on metal, glass shattering, a car folding in two, and smelled fire. I had time to wonder whether Lindsay had put her cigarette out. Then, Vicky Hallinan's face came rising out of the past. I heard laughter echoing and rolling all around me, swelling into a scream. Then nothing. The thing is, you don't get to know. It's not like you wake up with a bad feeling in your stomach. You don't see shadows where there shouldn't be any. You don't remember to tell your parents that you love them or, in my case, remember to say goodbye to them at all. If you're like me, you wake up 7 minutes and 47 seconds before your best friend is supposed to be picking you up. You're too busy worrying about how many roses you're going to get on Cupid Day to do anything more than throw on your clothes, brush your teeth, and pray to God you left your makeup in the bottom of your messenger bag so you can do it in the car. If you're like me, your last day starts like this. Chapter 1.
Beep, beep,
Lindsay calls out. A few weeks ago, my mom yelled at her for blasting her horn at 6:55 every morning, and this is Lindsay's solution. I'm coming, I shout back, even though she can see me pushing out the front door, trying to put on my coat and wrestle my binder into my bag at the same time. At the last second, my 8-year-old sister, Izzy, tugs at me. What? I whirl around. She has little sister radar for when I'm busy, late, or on the phone with my boyfriend. Those are always the times she chooses to bother me. You forgot your glove, she says, except it comes out. You forgot your glove. She refuses to go to speech therapy for her lisp, even though all the kids in her grade make fun of her. She says she likes the way she talks. I take them from her. They're cashmere, and she's probably gotten peanut butter on them. She's always scooping around in jars of the stuff. What did I tell you, Izzy? I say, poking her in the middle of the forehead. Don't touch my stuff. She giggles like an idiot, and I have to hustle her inside while I shut the door. If it were up to her, she would follow me around all day like a dog. By the time I make it out of the house, Lindsay's leaning out the window of the tank. That's what we call her car, an enormous silver Range Rover. Every time we drive around in it, at least one person says, "That thing's not a car, it's a truck." And Lindsay claims she could go head-to-head with an 18-wheeler and come out without a scratch. She and Allie are the only two of us with cars that actually belong to them. Allie's car is a tiny black Jetta that we named the Mini-Me. I get to borrow my mom's Accord sometimes. Poor Elodie has to make do with her father's ancient tan Ford Taurus, which hardly runs anymore. The air is still and freezing cold. The sky is a perfect pale blue. The sun has just risen, weak and watery-looking, like it has just spilled itself over the horizon and is too lazy to clean itself up. It's supposed to storm later, but you'd never know. I get into the passenger seat. Lindsay's already smoking, and she gestures with the end of her cigarette to the Dunkin' Donuts coffee she got for me. Bagels, I say.
In the back.
Sesame?
Obviously.
She looks me over once as she pulls out of my driveway.
Nice skirt.
You too. Lindsay tips her head, acknowledging the compliment. We're actually wearing the same skirt. There are only 2 days of the year when Lindsay, Allie, Elodie, and I deliberately dress the same. Pajama day during Spirit Week, because we all bought cute matching sets at Victoria's Secret last Christmas. And Cupid Day. We spent 3 hours at the mall arguing about whether to go for pink or red outfits. Lindsay hates pink. Allie lives in it. And we finally settled on black mini skirts and some red fur-trimmed tank tops we found in the clearance bin at Nordstrom. Like I said, those are the only times we deliberately look alike. But the truth is that at my high school, Thomas Jefferson, everyone kind of looks the same. There's no official uniform, it's a public school, but you'll see the same outfit of 7 jeans, gray New Balance sneakers, a white t-shirt, and a colored North Face fleece jacket on 9 out of 10 students. Even the guys and the girls dress the same, except our jeans are tighter and we have to blow out our hair every day. It's Connecticut. Being like the people around you is the whole point. That's not to say that our high school doesn't have its freaks. It does. But even the freaks are freaky in the same way. The eco-geeks ride their bikes to school and wear clothing made of hemp and never wash their hair, like having dreadlocks will somehow help curb the emission of greenhouse gases. The drama queens carry big bottles of lemon tea and wear scarves even in summer and don't talk in class because they're conserving their voices. The Math League members always have 10 times more books than anyone else and actually still use their lockers and walk around with permanently nervous expressions, like they're just waiting for somebody to yell, boo. I don't mind it, actually. Sometimes Lindsay and I make plans to run away after graduation and crash in a loft in New York City with this tattoo artist her stepbrother knows. But secretly, I like living in Ridgeview. It's reassuring, if you know what I mean. I lean forward, trying to apply mascara without gouging my eye out. Lindsay's never been the most careful driver and has a tendency to jerk the wheel around, come to sudden stops, and then gun the engine. Patrick better send me a rose, Lindsay says as she shoots through one stop sign and nearly breaks my neck slamming on the brakes at the next one. Patrick is Lindsay's on-again, off-again boyfriend. They've broken up a record 13 times since the start of the school year. I had to sit next to Rob while he filled out the request form, I say, rolling my eyes. It was like forced labor. Rob Cochran and I have been going out since October, but I've been in love with him since 6th grade, when he was too cool to talk to me. Rob was my first crush, or at least my first real crush. I did once kiss Kent McFuller in 3rd grade, but that obviously doesn't count since we just exchanged dandelion rings and were pretending to be husband and wife. Last year, I got 22 roses. Lindsay flicks her cigarette butt out of the window and leans over for a slurp of coffee. I'm going for 25 this year. Each year before Cupid Day, the student council sets up a booth outside the gym. For $2 each, you can buy your friends valograms, roses with little notes attached to them, and then they get delivered by Cupids, usually freshmen or sophomore girls trying to get in good with the upperclassmen, throughout the day. I'd be happy with 15, I say. It's a big deal how many roses you get. You can tell who's popular and who isn't by the number of roses they're holding. It's bad if you get under 10 and humiliating if you don't get more than 5. It basically means that you're either ugly or unknown, probably both. Sometimes people scavenge for dropped roses to add to their bouquets, but you can always tell. So, Lindsay shoots me a sideways glance. Are you excited? The big day, opening night, she laughs, no pun intended. I shrug and turn toward the window, watching my breath frost the pane. It's no big deal. Rob's parents are away this weekend, and a couple of weeks ago he asked me if I could spend the whole night at his house. I knew he was really asking if I wanted to have sex. We've gotten semi-close a few times, but it's always been in the back of his dad's BMW or in somebody's basement or in my den with my parents asleep upstairs, and it's always felt wrong. So when he asked me to stay the night, I said yes, without thinking about it. Lindsay squeals and hits her palm against the steering wheel. No big deal? Are you kidding? My baby's growing up. Oh, please. I feel heat creeping up my neck and know my skin's probably going red and splotchy. It does this whenever I'm embarrassed. All the dermatologists, creams, and powders in Connecticut don't help. When I was younger, kids used to sing, "What's red and white and weird all over? Sam Kingston." I shake my head a little and rub the vapor off the window. Outside, the world sparkles like it's been coated in varnish. When did you and Patrick do it anyway? Like, 3 months ago?
Yeah, but we've been making up for lost time since then.
Lindsay rocks against her seat. Gross.
Don't worry, kid. You'll be fine.
Don't call me kid. This is one reason I'm happy I decided to have sex with Rob tonight, so Lindsay and Elodie won't make fun of me anymore. Thankfully, since Allie's still a virgin, it means I won't be the very last one either. Sometimes I feel like, out of the four of us, I'm always the one tagging along, just there for the ride. I told you it was no big deal.
If you say so.
Lindsay has made me nervous, so I count all the mailboxes as we go by. I wonder if by tomorrow everything will look different to me. I wonder if I'll look different to other people. I hope so. We pull up to Elodie's house, and before Lindsay can even honk, the front door swings open and Elodie starts picking her way down the icy walkway, balancing on 3-inch heels like she can't get out of her house fast enough.
Nipply outside much?
Lindsay says when Elodie slides into the car. As usual, she's wearing only a thin leather jacket, even though the weather report said the high would be in the mid-20s. What's the point in looking cute if you can't show it off? Elodie shimmies her boobs and we crack up. It's impossible to stay stressed when she's around, and the knot in my stomach loosens. Elodie makes a clawing gesture with her hand and I pass her a coffee. We all take it the same way. Large hazelnut, no sugar, extra cream.
Watch where you're sitting. You'll squish the bagels.
Lindsay frowns into the rearview mirror.
You know you want a piece of this.
Elodie gives her butt a smack and we all laugh again.
Save it for muffin, you horn dog.
Steve Doe is Elodie's latest victim. She calls him Muffin because of his last name and because he's yummy, she says. He looks too greasy for me and he always smells like pot. They've been hooking up for a month and a half now. Elodie's the most experienced of any of us. She lost her virginity sophomore year and has already had sex with 2 different guys. She was the one who told me she was sore after the first couple of times she had sex, which made me 10 times more nervous. It may sound crazy, but I never really thought of it as something physical, something that would make you sore, like soccer or horseback riding. I'm scared that I won't know what to do. Like when we used to play basketball in gym and I'd always forget who I was supposed to be guarding or when I should pass the ball and when I should dribble it.
Muffin. Elodie puts a hand on her stomach. I'm starving.
There's a bagel for you, I say.
Sesame?
Elodie asks.
Obviously.
Lindsay and I say at the same time. Lindsay winks at me. Just before we get to school, we roll down the windows and blast Mary J. Blige's No More Drama. I close my eyes and think back to homecoming and my first kiss with Rob when he pulled me toward him on the dance floor and suddenly my lips were on his and his tongue was sliding under my tongue and I could feel the heat from all the colored lights pressing down on me like a hand. And the music seemed to echo somewhere behind my ribs, making my heart flutter and skip in time. The cold air coming through the window makes my throat hurt, and the bass comes through the soles of my feet just like it did that night when I thought I would never be happier. It goes all the way up to my head, making me dizzy like the whole car is going to split apart from the sound. Popularity, an analysis. Popularity is a weird thing. You can't really define it, and it's not cool to talk about it, but you know it when you see it, like a lazy eye or porn. Lindsay's gorgeous, but the rest of us aren't that much prettier than anybody else. Here are my good traits. Big green eyes, straight white teeth, high cheekbones, long legs. Here are my bad traits. A too long nose, skin that gets blotchy when I'm nervous, a flat butt. Becky DeFiore is just as pretty as Lindsay, and I don't think Becky even had a date to junior homecoming. Allie's boobs are pretty big,
but mine are borderline non-existent. When Lindsay's in a bad mood, she calls me Samuel, not Sam or Samantha. And it's not like we're shiny perfect or our breath always smells like lilacs or something. Lindsay once had a burping contest with Jonas Sasanoff in the cafeteria and everyone applauded her. Sometimes Elodie wears fuzzy yellow slippers to school. I once laughed so hard in social studies, I spit up vanilla latte all over Jake Summers' desk. A month later, we made out in Lily Angler's tool shed. He was bad. The point is, we can do things like that. You know why? Because we're popular. And we're popular because we can get away with everything. So it's circular. I guess what I'm saying is there's no point in analyzing it. If you draw a circle, there will always be an inside and an outside. And unless you're a total nut job, it's pretty easy to see which is which. It's just what happens. I'm not gonna lie, though. It's nice that everything's easy for us. It's a good feeling knowing you can basically do whatever you want and there won't be any consequences. When we get out of high school, we'll look back and know we did everything right. That we kissed the cutest boys and went to the best parties, got in just enough trouble, listened to our music too loud, smoked too many cigarettes, and drank too much and laughed too much and listened too little or not at all. If high school were a game of poker, Lindsay, Allie, Elodie, and I would be holding 80% of the cards. And believe me, I know what it's like to be on the other side. I was there for the first half of my life. The bottom of the bottom, lowest of the low. I know what it's like to have to squabble and pick and fight over the leftovers. So now, I have first pick of everything. So what? That's the way it is. Nobody ever said life was fair. We pull into the parking lot exactly 10 minutes before first bell. Lindsay guns it toward the lower lot, where the faculty spaces are, scattering a group of sophomore girls. I can see red and white lace dresses peeking out under their coats, and one of them is wearing a tiara. Cupids, definitely. Come on, come on, come on, Lindsay mutters as we pull behind the gym. This is the only row in the lower lot not reserved for staff. We call it Senior Alley, even though Lindsay's been parking here since junior year. It's the VIP of parking at Jefferson, and if you miss out on a spot, there are only 20 of them, you have to park all the way in the upper lot, which is a full 0.22 miles from the main entrance. We checked one time, and now, whenever we talk about it, we have to use the exact distance. Like, do you really want to walk 0.22 miles in this rain? Lindsay squeals when she sees an open space, jerking her wheel to the left. At the same time, Sarah Grundle is pulling up her brown Chevrolet from the other direction, angling it into the spot. Oh, hell no. No way. Lindsay leans on the horn, even though it's obvious Sarah was here before us, then presses her foot on the accelerator. Elodie shrieks as hot coffee sloshes all over her shirt. There is the high-pitched squeal of rubber, and Sarah Grundle slams on her brakes just before Lindsay's Range Rover takes off her bumper. Nice. Lindsay pulls into the spot and throws her car in park. Then she opens her door and leans out. Sorry, sweetie, she calls to Sarah. I didn't see you there. This is obviously a lie. Great. Elodie is mopping up coffee with a balled-up Dunkin' Donuts napkin. Now I get to go around all day with my boobs smelling like hazelnut. Guys like food smells, I say. I read it in Glamour. Put a cookie down your pants and Muffin will probably jump you before homeroom. Lindsay flips down the rearview mirror and checks her face. Maybe you should try it with Rob, Sammy. Elodie throws the coffee-stained napkin at me and I catch it and peg it back. What? She's laughing. You didn't think I'd forget about your big night, did you? She fishes in her bag, and the next thing that flies over the seat is a crumpled-up condom with bits of tobacco stuck to its wrapper. Lindsay cracks up. You're pagans, I say, taking the condom with two fingers and dropping it in Lindsay's glove compartment. Just touching it gets my nerves going again, and I can feel something twist at the bottom of my stomach. I never understood why condoms are kept in those little foil wrappers. They look so clinical, like something your doctor would prescribe for allergies or intestinal problems. No glove, no love, Elodie says, leaning forward and kissing my cheek. She leaves a big circle of pink lip gloss there. Come on. I get out of the car before they can see I'm blushing. Mr. Otto, the athletic director, is standing outside the gym when we're getting out of the car, probably checking out our asses. Elodie thinks the reason he insisted his office be right next to the girls' dressing room is because he rigged up a camera feed from his computer to the toilet. Why else would he even need a computer? He's the athletic director. Now every time I pee in the gym, I get paranoid. Move it, ladies, he calls to us. He's also the soccer coach, which is ironic since he probably couldn't run to the vending machine and back. He looks like a walrus. He even has a mustache. I don't want to have to give you a late slip. I don't want to have to spank you. I do an impression of his voice, which is strangely high-pitched. Another reason Elodie thinks he might be a pedophile. Elodie and Lindsay crack up. 2 minutes to bell, Otto says more sharply. Maybe he heard me. I don't really care. Happy Friday, Lindsay grumbles and puts her arm through mine. Elodie has taken out her cell phone and is checking her teeth in its reflective back, picking out sesame seeds with a pinky nail. This sucks, she says without looking up. Totally, I say. Fridays are the hardest in some ways. You're so close to freedom. Kill me now. No way, Lindsay squeezes my arm. Can't let my best friend die a virgin. You see, we didn't know. My first two periods, art and AHAP, American History Advanced Placement, AHAP, history's always been my best subject. I get only 5 roses. I'm not that stressed about it, although it does kind of piss me off that Eileen Cho gets 4 roses from her boyfriend, Ian Dowell. It didn't even occur to me to ask Rob to do that. And in a way, I don't think it's fair. It makes people think you've got more friends than you do. As soon as I make it to chemistry, Mr. Tierney announces a pop quiz. This is a big problem since, one, I haven't understood a word of my homework in 4 weeks. Okay, so I stopped trying after week one. And two, Mr. Tierney's always threatening to phone in failing grades to college admissions committees, since a lot of us haven't been accepted to school yet. I'm not sure whether he's serious or whether he's just trying to keep the seniors in line, but there is no way I'm letting some fascist teacher ruin my chances of getting into BU. Even worse, I'm sitting next to Lauren Lornet, possibly the only person in the class more clueless about this stuff than I am. Actually, my grades have been pretty good in chem this year, but it isn't because I've had a sudden epiphany about proton-electron interaction. My straight A-minus average can be summarized in 2 words. Jeremy Ball. He's skinnier than I am, and his breath always smells like cornflakes, but he lets me copy his homework and inches his desk closer to mine on test days so I can peek over at his answers without being obvious. Unfortunately, since I stop before Tierney's class to pee and check in with Allie, we always meet in the bathroom before 4th period, since she has biology at the same time I have chem. I arrive too late to get my usual seat next to Jeremy. There are 3 questions on Mr. Tierney's quiz, and I don't know enough to fake an answer to a single one. Next to me, Lauren's doubled over her paper, tongue just poking out between her teeth. She always does that when she thinks. Her first answer's looking pretty good, actually. Her answers are neat and deliberate, not frantically scribbled like you do when you don't know what you're talking about and are hoping if you scrawl enough, your teacher won't notice. For the record, it never works. Then I remember that Mr. Tierney lectured Lauren about improving her grade last week. Maybe she's been studying extra hard. I peek over Lauren's shoulder and copy down 2 of her answers. I'm good at being subtle about it. When Mr. Tierney calls out, 3 minutes. He says it dramatically, like he's doing a voiceover for a movie, and it makes the fat under his chin wiggle. It looks like Lauren's finished and checking her work, but she's leaning so I can't see the 3rd answer. I watch the 2nd hand tick its way around the clock. 2 minutes and 30 seconds. Tierney booms, and I lean over and poke Lauren with my pen. She looks up, startled. I don't think I've talked to her in years, and for a second, I see a look pass over her face that I can't quite identify. Pen, I mouth to her. She looks confused and shoots a glance up at Tierney, who's thankfully bent over the textbook. What? She whispers. I make some gestures with my pen, trying to communicate to her that I've run out of ink. She's staring at me dumbly, and for a second, I feel like reaching out and shaking her 2 minutes. But finally, her face clears up, and she grins like she's just figured out how to cure cancer. I don't want to sound harsh, but it's such a waste to be a dork and kind of slow on the uptake. What's the point if you can't at least play Beethoven or win state spelling bees or go to Harvard or something? While Lauren's bent over, rummaging for a pen in her bag, I copy down the final answer. I kind of forget I even asked her for a pen, actually, because she has to whisper at me to get my attention.
30 seconds!
Here. I take it from her. One end is chewed. Gross. I give her a tight smile and look away, but a second later she whispers, "Does it work?" I give her a look so she'll know that now she's being annoying. I guess she takes it as a sign I don't understand. "The pen! Does it work?" She whispers a little louder. That's when Tierney slams the textbook against his desk. The sound is so loud we all jump.
"Ms. Lornet," he bellows, glaring at Lauren, "are you talking during my quiz?"
She turns bright red and looks back and forth from me to the teacher, licking her lips. I don't say anything. "I was just," she says faintly.
"Enough!"
He stands up, frowning so hard his mouth looks like it's going to melt into his neck, and crosses his arms. I think he's going to say something more to Lauren because he's shooting her a death stare, but instead, he just says,
"Time, everybody! Pencils and pens down!"
I go to give Lauren's pen back to her, but she won't take it.
"Keep it," she says.
"No thanks," I say. I hold it between two fingers and lean over, dangling it above her desk, but she tucks her hands behind her back.
"Seriously," she says, "you're gonna need a pen for notes and stuff."
She's looking at me like she's offering me something miraculous and not a Bic pen with slobber on it. I don't know if it's her expression or not, but all of a sudden I remember the time we went on a field trip in second grade, and the two of us were the only ones left after everyone had chosen their buddies. We had to hold hands for the rest of the day whenever we crossed the street, and hers were always sweaty. I wonder if she remembers.
I hope not.
I smile tightly and drop the pen in my bag. She grins from ear to ear. I throw it out as soon as we're done with class, of course. You never know what kind of diseases get carried through slobber. On the bright side, my mom always said you should do one nice thing a day. So I guess that means I'm in the clear. Math class. Further lessons in chemistry. Fourth period, I have life skills, which is what they call gym when you're old enough to be offended by forced physical activity. Elodie thinks we should call it slavery instead for accuracy. We're studying CPR, which means we get to make out with life-size dummies in front of Mr. Otto. More proof of his perviness. Fifth period, I have calc, and the Cupids come early, just after class has started. One of them is wearing a shiny red unitard and has devil's horns. One of them looks like she might be dressed as the Playboy Bunny or maybe the Easter Bunny in heels. One of them is dressed up like an angel. Their costumes don't really make sense in the context of the holiday, but like I said, the whole point is to show off in front of the junior and senior boys. I don't blame them. We did it too. Freshman year, Allie dated Mike Harmon, a senior at the time, for 2 months after she delivered a valigram to him and he said her butt looked cute in her tights. That's a real love story right there. The devil gives me 3 roses, one from Elodie, one from Tara Flute, who's kind of in our group but not really, and one from Rob. I make a big deal of unfolding the tiny card that's looped around the rose stem and acting moved when I read the note, even though all he's written is, "Happy Cupid Day. Love ya." And then in smaller letters near the bottom, "Happy now." "Love ya" isn't exactly "I love you," which we've never said, but it's getting close. I'm pretty sure he's saving it for tonight, actually.
Last week, it was late, and we were sitting on his couch, and he was staring at me, and I was sure, sure he was going to say it. But instead, he just said, from a certain angle, I looked like Scarlett Johansson. At least my note is better than the one Allie got from Matt Wild last year. Roses are red, violets are blue. If I get you in bed, it would be really cool. He was kidding, obviously, but still. Blue and cool don't even rhyme. I think that's going to be all of my valigrams. But then the angel comes over to my desk and hands me another one. The roses are all different colors, and this one's pretty amazing. Cream and pink swirled petals, like it's made out of some kind of ice cream. It's beautiful, she breathes. I look up. The angel is just standing there, staring at the rose lying on my desk. It's pretty shocking for a lower classman to have the balls to speak to a senior, and it annoys me for a second. She doesn't look like the average Cupid either. She has hair so pale blonde it's almost white, and I can see individual veins through her skin. She reminds me of someone, but I can't remember who. She catches me looking at her and gives me a quick, embarrassed smile. I'm happy to see some color rush into her face. At least it makes her look alive. Marion! She turns around when the devil girl calls to her. The devil makes an impatient gesture with the roses she's still carrying, and the angel, Marion, I guess, quickly rejoins the other Cupids. All three of them leave. I brush my finger over the rose petals. They're as soft as anything, as air or a breath, and then instantly feel stupid. I open the note, expecting something from Allie or Lindsay. Hers always say, "Love you to death, bitch." But instead, I see a cartoon drawing of a fat Cupid accidentally shooting a bird out of a tree. The bird is labeled American Bald Eagle, and it looks like it's about to fall directly on top of a couple sitting on a bench. Cupid's original target, presumably. Cupid's eyes are spirals, and he has a stupid grin on his face. Underneath the cartoon, it says, "Don't drink and love." It's obviously from Kent McFuller. He draws cartoons for the Tribulation, the school humor paper. And I look up and glance in his direction. He always sits in the back left corner of the room. It's one weird thing about him, but definitely not the only one. Sure enough, he's watching me. He gives me a quick smile and a wave, then makes a motion with his arms like he's pulling back an arrow on a bowstring and shooting it at me. I make a point of frowning and deliberately take his note, fold it up quickly, and toss it in the bottom of my bag. He doesn't seem to mind, though. It's like I can feel his smile burning on me. Mr. Daimler comes up and down the aisles, collecting homework, and he pauses at my desk. I have to admit it. He's the reason I'm psyched to get 4 valigrams in calc. Mr. Daimler's only 25, and he's gorgeous. He's assistant coach of the soccer team, and it's pretty funny to see him standing next to Otto. They're complete physical opposites. Mr. Daimler's over 6 feet, always tan, and dresses like we do, in jeans and fleeces and New Balance sneakers. He graduated from Thomas Jefferson. We looked him up once in the old yearbooks in the library. He was prom king, and in one picture he's wearing a tux and smiling with his arm around his prom date. You can just see a hemp necklace peeking out of his shirt collar. I love that picture. But you know what I love even more? He still wears that hemp necklace. So ironic that the hottest guy at Thomas Jefferson is on the faculty. As usual, when he smiles, my stomach does a little flip. He runs a hand through his messy brown hair, and I fantasize about doing the same thing. 9 roses already? He raises his eyebrows, makes a big show of checking his watch. And it's only 11:15. Well done. What can I say? I make my voice as smooth and flirtatious as possible. The people love me. I can see that, he says and winks at me. I let him move a little farther down the aisle before I say loudly, I still haven't gotten my rose from you, Mr. Daimler. He doesn't turn around, but I can see the tips of his ears go red. There are giggles and snorts from the class. I get that rush that comes when you know you're doing something wrong and are getting away with it, like stealing something from the school cafeteria or getting tipsy at a family holiday without anyone knowing. Lindsay says Mr. Daimler is going to sue me for harassment one day. I don't think so,
I think he secretly likes it. Case in point. When he turns around to face the class, he's smiling.
After reviewing last week's test results, I realize there's still a lot of confusion about asymptotes and limits.
He begins leaning against his desk and crossing his legs at the ankle. Nobody else could make calculus even remotely interesting, I'm sure of it. For the rest of the class, he barely looks at me, and even then, only when I raise my hand. But I swear that when our eyes do meet, it makes my whole body feel like a giant shiver. And I swear he's feeling it too. After class, Kent catches up with me.
So, he says, what did you think?
Of what? I say to irritate him. I know he's talking about the cartoon and the rose. Kent just smiles and changes the subject.
My parents are away this weekend.
Good for you. His smile doesn't waver. I'm having a party tonight. You coming? I look at him. I've never understood Kent, or at least I haven't understood him in years. We were super close when we were little. Technically, I suppose he was my best friend as well as my first kiss, but as soon as he hit middle school, he started getting weirder and weirder. Since freshman year, he's always worn a blazer to school, even though most of the ones he owns are ripped at the seams or have holes in the elbows. He wears the same scuffed-up black and white checkered sneakers every day, and his hair is so long it's like a curtain that swings down over his eyes every 5 seconds. But the real deal-breaker is this. He actually wears a bowler hat to school. The worst thing is that he could be cute. He has the face and the body for it. He has a tiny heart-shaped mole under his left eye. No joke. But he has to screw it up by being such a freak. Not sure what my plans are yet, I say. If that's where everyone ends up. I let my voice trail off so he knows I'll only show if there's nothing better to do. It's gonna be great, he says, still smiling. Another infuriating thing about Kent. He acts like the world is one big shiny present he gets to unwrap every morning. We'll see, I say. Down the hall, I see Rob ducking into the cafeteria, and I start walking faster, hoping Kent will get the picture and back off. It's pretty optimistic thinking on my part. Kent has had a crush on me for years, possibly even since our kiss. He stops walking entirely, maybe hoping I'll stop too, but I don't. For a second, I feel bad, like I was too harsh. But then his voice rings out after me, and I can tell just by the sound of it that he's still smiling. See you tonight, he says. I hear the squeak of his sneakers on the linoleum, and I know he's turned around and started off in the opposite direction. He starts whistling. The sound of it carries back to me, getting fainter. It takes me a while to place the tune. The sun'll come out tomorrow. Bet your bottom dollar that tomorrow there'll be sun. From Annie. The musical. My favorite song when I was 7. I know no one else in the hall will get it, but still I'm embarrassed and can feel heat creeping up my neck. He's always doing things like that. Acting like he knows me better than anyone else just because we used to play in the sandbox together 100 years ago. Acting like nothing that's happened in the past 10 years has changed anything, even though it's changed everything. My phone's buzzing in my back pocket, and before I go into lunch, I snap it open. There's one new text from Lindsay. Party at Kent McFreaky's tonight. In? I pause for just a second, blowing out a long breath before I text back. Ob. There are 3 acceptable things to eat in the Thomas Jefferson cafeteria. 1, a bagel, plain or with cream cheese. 2, French fries. 3, a deli sandwich from the make-your-own sandwich bar. A, but only with turkey, ham, or chicken breast. Salami and bologna are obvious no-nos, and roast beef is questionable, which is a shame because roast beef is my favorite. Rob is standing over by the cash register with a group of his friends. He's holding an enormous tray of fries. He eats them every day. He catches my eye and gives me a nod. He's not the kind of guy who does so well with feelings, his or mine, thus the love ya on the note he sent me.
It's weird. Before we were going out, I liked him so much, and for so long, that every time he even looked in my direction, I would get this bubbling, fizzing feeling so strong it would make me dizzy. No lie. Sometimes I got lightheaded thinking about him and had to sit down. But now that we're officially a couple, I sometimes have the strangest thoughts when I look at him. Like, I wonder if all those fries are clogging his arteries, or whether he flosses, or how long it's been since he washed the Yankees hat he wears pretty much every day. Sometimes I'm worried there's something wrong with me. Who wouldn't want to go out with Rob Cochran? It's not that I'm not totally happy. I am. But it's almost like sometimes I have to keep running over and over in my head why I liked him in the first place. Like, if I don't, I'll somehow forget. Thankfully, there are a million good reasons. The fact that he has black hair and a billion freckles that somehow they don't look stupid on him. That he's loud but in a funny way. That everyone knows him and likes him, and probably half the girls in the school have a crush on him. That he looks good in his lacrosse jersey. That when he's really tired, he lays his head on my shoulder and falls asleep. That's my favorite thing about him. I like to lie next to him when it's late, dark, and so quiet I can hear my own heartbeat. It's times like that when I'm sure that I'm in love. I ignore Rob as I get in line to pay for my bagel. I can play hard to get, too. And then head for the senior section. The rest of the cafeteria is a rectangle. Special ed kids sit all the way down at the table closest to the classrooms. And then there are the freshman tables, and then the sophomore tables, and then the junior tables. The senior section is at the very head of the cafeteria. It's an octagon lined completely with windows. Okay, so it only looks out over the parking lot, but it's still better than getting a straight view of the short bus brigade dribbling their applesauce. No offense. Allie's already sitting at a small circular table right by the window. Our favorite. Hey. I put down my tray and my roses. Allie's bouquet is sitting on the table, and I do a quick count. 9 roses. I gesture to hers and then give my bouquet a rattle. Same as me. She makes a face. One of mine doesn't count. Ethan Schlosky sent one to me. Can you believe it? Stalker. Yeah, well, I got one from Kent McFuller, so one of mine doesn't count either. He loves you, she says, drawing out the O. Did you get Lindsay's text? I pick the mushy center out of my bagel and pop it in my mouth. Are we really going to go to his party? Allie snorts. Afraid he'll date rape you? Very funny. There's going to be a keg, Allie says. She takes a tiny nibble of her turkey sandwich. My house after school, okay? She doesn't really have to ask. It's our tradition on Fridays. We order food, raid her closet, blast music, and dance around swapping eyeshadows and lip glosses. Yeah, sure. I've been watching Rob come closer out of the corner of my eye, and suddenly he's there, plopping into a chair next to me and leaning in until his mouth is touching my left ear. He smells like total cologne. He always does. I think it smells a little like this tea my grandmother used to drink, lemon balm, but I haven't told him that yet. Hey, Slammer! He's always making up names for me. Slammer, Sandwich, Sammy Says. Did you get my Valigram? Did you get mine? I say. He swings his backpack off his shoulder and unzips it. There are a half dozen crumpled roses in the bottom of his bag. I'm assuming one of them is mine, and besides that, an empty pack of cigarettes, a pack of Trident gum, his cell phone, and a change of shirts. He's not so much into studying. Who are the other roses from? I say, teasing him. Your competition, he says, arching his eyebrows. Very classy, Allie says. Are you going to Kent's party tonight, Rob? Probably. Rob shrugs and suddenly looks bored. Here's a secret. One time when we were kissing, I opened my eyes and saw that his eyes were open. He wasn't even looking at me. He was looking over my shoulder, watching the room. He's getting a keg, Allie says for the second time. Everyone jokes that going to Jefferson prepares you for the total college experience. You learn to work, and you learn to drink. 2 years ago, the New York Times ranked us among the top 10 booziest public schools in Connecticut. It's not like there's anything else to do around here, though. We've got malls and basement parties. That's it. Let's face it, that's how most of the country is. My dad always said that they should take down the Statue of Liberty and put up a big strip mall instead, or those golden McDonald's arches. He said at least that way people would know what to expect. Excuse me. Lindsay's standing behind Rob, clearing her throat. She has her arms folded and she's tapping her foot.
You're in my seat, Cochran, she says. She's only pretending to be hardcore.
Rob and Lindsay have always been friends. At least, they've always been in the same group, and by necessity, have always had to be friends.
My apologies, Edgecombe.
He gets up and makes a big flourish like a bow when she sits down. See you tonight, Rob, Allie says and adds, bring your friends.
I'll see you later.
Rob leans down and buries his face in my hair, making his voice deep and quiet. That voice used to make all of the nerves in my body light up like a firework explosion. Now, sometimes, I think it's cheesy.
Don't forget, it's all about you and me tonight.
I haven't forgotten, I say, hoping my voice sounds sexy and not scared. My palms are sweating and I pray he doesn't try to take my hand. Thankfully, he doesn't. Instead, he bends down and presses his mouth into mine. We make out for a bit until Lindsay squeals,
not while I'm eating,
and throws a fry in my direction. It hits me on my shoulder.
Bye, ladies,
Rob says and saunters off with his hat just tilted on an angle. I wipe my mouth on a napkin when nobody's looking, since the bottom half of my face is now coated with Rob's saliva. Here's another secret about Rob. I hate the way he kisses. Elodie says all my stressing is just insecurity because Rob and I haven't actually sealed the deal yet. Once we do, she's positive I'll feel better. And I'm sure she's right. After all, she's the expert. Elodie is the last to join us at lunch, and we all make a grab for her fries when she sets down her tray. She makes a half-hearted attempt to swat our hands away. She slaps her bouquet of roses down next. She has 12, and I feel a momentary twinge of jealousy. I guess Allie feels it too because she says, what did you have to do for those?
Who did you have to do?
Lindsay corrects her. Elodie sticks her tongue out, but seems pleased that we noticed. All of a sudden, Allie looks at something over my shoulder and starts giggling.
Psycho killer. Qu'est-ce que c'est?
We all turn around. Juliet Sykes, or Psycho, has just drifted into the senior section. That's how she walks, like she's drifting, being blown around by forces outside of her control. She's carrying a brown paper bag in her long, pale fingers. Her face is shielded behind a curtain of pale blonde hair, shoulders hunched up around her ears. For the most part, everyone in the cafeteria ignores her. She's the definition of forgettable, but Lindsay, Allie, Elodie, and I start making that screeching and stabbing motion from Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, which we all watched at a sleepover a couple of years ago. Afterward, we had to sleep with the lights on. I'm not sure if Juliet hears us. Lindsay always says she can't hear at all because the voices in her head are too loud. Juliet keeps up that same slow pace across the room, eventually reaching the door that leads out into the parking lot. I'm not sure where she eats every day. I hardly ever see her in the cafeteria. She has to shove her shoulder against the door a few times before it will open, like she's too frail to make it work.
Did she get our valogram?
Lindsay says, licking salt off a fry before popping it in her mouth. Allie nods. In bio. I was sitting right behind her.
Did she say anything?
Does she ever say anything? Allie puts one hand across her heart, pretending to be upset. She threw the rose out as soon as class was over. Can you believe it? Right in front of me. Freshman year, Lindsay somehow found out that Juliet hadn't been sent a single valogram. Not one. So Lindsay put a note on one of her roses and duct taped it on Juliet's locker. The note said, maybe next year, but probably not. Every year since then, we've sent her a rose and the same note on Cupid Day. The only note she's ever received from anyone, as far as I know. Maybe next year, but probably not. Normally, I would feel bad, but Juliet deserves her nickname. She's a freak. Rumor has it that she was once found by her parents on Route 84, stark naked at 3 a.m., straddling the highway divider. Last year, Lacey Kennedy said she saw Juliet in the bathroom by the science wing, stroking her hair over and over and staring at her reflection. And Juliet never says a word. Hasn't for years, as far as I know. Lindsay hates her. I think Lindsay and Juliet were in a couple of the same elementary school classes, and for all I know, Lindsay has hated her since then. She makes the sign of the cross whenever Juliet's around, like Juliet might somehow go vampire and make a lunge for Lindsay's throat. It was Lindsay who found out Juliet peed her sleeping bag during a Girl Scout camping trip in fifth grade, and Lindsay who gave her the nickname Mellow Yellow. People called Juliet that forever until the end of freshman year, if you can believe it, and stayed away from her because they said she smelled like pee. I'm looking out the window, and I watch Juliet's hair flash in the sunlight like it's catching fire. There's darkness on the horizon, a smudge where the storm is growing. It occurs to me for the first time that I'm not exactly sure why Lindsay started hating Juliet in the first place, or when. I open my mouth to ask her, but they've already moved on to other topics. Catfight, Elodie finishes and Allie giggles. I'm terrified, Lindsay says sarcastically. Clearly I've missed something. What's going on? I say. Elodie turns to me. Sarah Grundle is going around saying Lindsay ruined her life. I have to wait while Elodie folds a fry expertly into her mouth. She can't swim in the quarterfinals. And you know she lives for that shit. Remember when she forgot to take her goggles off after morning practice and she wore them until second period? She probably keeps all of her blue ribbons on a wall in her room, Allie says. Sam used to do that, didn't you, Sam? All those ribbons for playing with horses? Lindsay elbows me. Can we get back to the point? I wave my hands, partly because I want to hear the story. Partly to take the attention off me and the fact that I used to be a dork. When I was in fifth grade, I spent more time with horses than with members of my own species. I still don't get why Sarah's pissed at Lindsay. Elodie rolls her eyes at me like I belong at the special ed table. Sarah got detention. She was late to homeroom for, like, the fifth time in 2 weeks. I'm still not getting it, and she heaves a sigh. She was late to homeroom because she had to park in upper lot and haul ass 0.22 miles. We all bust it out at the same time and then start giggling like maniacs. Don't worry, Linz, I say. If you guys throw down, I'm totally putting money on you. Yeah, we've got your back, Elodie says. Isn't it kind of weird how that stuff happens? Allie says in this shy voice she gets when she's trying to say something serious. How everything spirals out from everything else. Like, if Lindsay hadn't stolen that parking space.
I didn't steal it. I got it fair and square.
Lindsay protests, bringing her hand down on the table for emphasis. Elodie's Diet Coke sloshes over the side of the can, soaking some fries. This makes us start laughing again. I'm serious. Allie raises her voice to be heard over us. It's like a web, you know? Everything's connected. Have you been breaking into your dad's stash again, Al? Elodie says.
This is all it takes to really get us going. This is a joke we've had with Allie for years because her dad works in the music industry. He's a lawyer, not a producer or manager or musician or anything, and he wears a suit everywhere, even to the pool in the summer. But Lindsay claims he's secretly a hippie stoner. As we're laughing, doubling over, Allie turns pink.
You guys never listen to me, she says, but she's fighting a smile. She takes a fry and throws it at Elodie. I read once that if a bunch of butterflies takes off from Thailand, it can cause a rainstorm in New York.
Yeah, well, one of your farts could cause a massive blackout in Portugal.
Elodie giggles, throwing a fry back.
Your morning breath could cause a stampede in Africa, Allie leans forward, and I do not fart.
Lindsay and I are laughing, and Elodie and Allie keep throwing fries back and forth. Lindsay tries to say they're wasting perfectly good grease, but she's snorting so hard she can barely get the words out. Finally, she sucks in a deep breath and chokes out, "You know what I heard? That if you sneeze enough, you can cause a tornado in Iowa." Even Allie goes crazy at this, and suddenly we're all trying it, laughing and sneezing and snorting at the same time. Everybody's staring at us, but we don't care. After about a million sneezes, Lindsay leans back in her chair, clutching her stomach and gasping for breath. 30 dead in Iowa tornadoes, she gets out. Another 50 missing. This sets us off again. Lindsay and I decide to cut seventh period and go to TCBY. Lindsay has French, which she can't stand, and I have English. We cut seventh period a lot together. We're second semester seniors, so it's like we're expected not to go to class. Plus, I hate my English teacher, Mrs. Harbor. She's always going off on tangents. Sometimes I'll zone out for a few minutes, and all of a sudden she'll be talking about underwear in the 18th century, or oppression in Africa, or the way the sun looks rising over the Grand Canyon. Even though she's probably only in her 50s, I'm pretty sure she's losing it. That's how it started with my grandmother. Ideas swirling around and colliding with each other, causes coming after effects, and point A switched with point B. When my grandmother was still alive, we would visit her, and even though I was no more than 6, I remember thinking, "I hope I die young." There's a definition of irony for you, Mrs. Harbor. Or maybe foreshadowing? Technically, you need a special pass signed by your parents and the administration to leave campus during the school day. This wasn't always true. For a long time, one of the perks to being a senior was getting to leave campus whenever you wanted, as long as you had a free period. That was 20 years ago, though, a few years before Thomas Jefferson got the reputation for one of the highest teen suicide rates in the country. We looked up the article online once. The Connecticut Post called us suicide high. And then one day, a bunch of kids left campus and drove off a bridge. A suicide pact, I guess. Anyway, after that, the school forbade anyone from leaving school during the day without special permission. It's kind of stupid if you think about it. That's like finding out that kids are bringing vodka to school and water bottles and forbidding anyone to drink water. Fortunately, there's another way to get off campus. Through a hole in the fence beyond the gym by the tennis court, which we call the smoker's lounge, since that's where all the smokers hang out. No one's around, though, when Lindsay and I slip through the fence and get started across the woods. In a little while, we'll come on to Route 120. Everything is still and frozen. Twigs and black leaves crack under our shoes, and our breath rises in solid white puffs. Thomas Jefferson is about 3 miles outside of downtown Ridgeview, or what you can call the downtown, but only about a half mile from a small strip of dingy stores we've named The Row. There's a gas station, a TCBY, a Chinese restaurant that once made Elodie sick for 2 days, and a random Hallmark store where you can buy pink, glittery ballerina figurines and snow globes and crap like that. That's where we head. I know we must look like total freaks stomping along the road in our skirts and tights, our jackets flapping open to show off our fur-trimmed tank tops. We pass Hunan Kitchen on our way to TCBY. Through the grime-coated windows, we spot Alex Lament and Anna Cartulo bent over a bowl of something. "Ooh, scandal," Lindsay says, raising her eyebrows. Although it's really only a half scandal. Everyone knows that Alex has been cheating on Bridget McGuire with Anna for the past 3 months. Everyone except Bridget, obviously. Bridget's family is super Catholic. She's pretty and really clean looking, like every time you see her, she's just scrubbed her face really hard. Apparently she's saving herself for marriage. That's what she says, anyway, although Elodie thinks Bridget might be a closet lesbo. Anna Cartulo is only a junior, but if the rumors are true, she's already had sex with at least 4 people. She's one of the few kids in Ridgeview who doesn't come from any money.
Her mom's a hairdresser, and I don't even know if she has a dad. She lives in one of those shitty rental condos right off the row. I once heard Andrew Singer saying her bedroom always smelled like General Tso's chicken. "Let's go in and say hi," Lindsay says, reaching for my hand. I hang back. "I'm going through sugar withdrawal." "Here, take these." She pulls a pack of sweet tarts from the waistband of her skirt. Lindsay always carries candy on her, 24/7, like she's packing drugs. I guess she kind of is. "Just for a second, I promise." I let myself be dragged inside. A bell tinkles as we come through the door. There's a woman flipping through Us Weekly behind the counter. She looks at us, then looks down again when she realizes we're not going to order. Lindsay slides right up to Alex and Anna's booth, leaning against the table. She's kind of sort of friends with Alex. Alex is kind of sort of friends with a lot of people since he deals pot out of a shoebox in his bedroom. He and I have a head nod friendship, since that's pretty much the limit of our interaction. He's actually in English with me, though he shows even less than I do. I guess the rest of the time he's with Anna. Every so often he'll say something like, "That essay assignment blows, huh?" But other than that, we don't talk. "Hey, hey," Lindsay says. "You going to Kent's party tonight?" Alex's face is red and splotchy. At least he's embarrassed to be caught out with Anna so blatantly. Or maybe he's just having a reaction to the food. I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know. Maybe. Gotta see. He trails off. "It's gonna be super fun." Lindsay makes her voice extra perky. "Are you gonna bring Bridget? She is such a sweetheart." Actually, we both think Bridget is annoying. She's always really cheerful, and she wears t-shirts with lame slogans like, "Unless you're the lead dog, the view never changes." No lie. But Lindsay despises Anna and once wrote AC equals WT all over the bathroom right across from the cafeteria, the one everyone uses. WT stands for white trash. The situation is beyond awkward, so I blurt out, "Sesame chicken!" I point at the meat congealing in a grayish sauce in a bowl on the table next to two fortune cookies and a sad-looking orange. "Orange beef," Alex says. He seems relieved by the change of topic. Lindsay gives me a look, annoyed, but I keep rattling on. "You should be careful about eating here. The chicken once poisoned Elodie. She threw up for, like, 2 days straight. If it was chicken. She swears she found a furball in it." As soon as I say this, Anna picks up her chopsticks and takes an enormous bite, looking up and smiling at me as she chews so I can see the food in her mouth. I'm not sure whether she's doing it deliberately to gross me out, but it seems like it. "That's nasty, Kingston," Alex says, but he's smiling now. Lindsay rolls her eyes like Alex and Anna are both a total waste of our time. "Come on, Sam." She pockets a fortune cookie and breaks it open when we get outside. "Happiness is found when one is not looking," she reads, and I crack up when she makes a face. She balls up the little slip of paper and lets it flutter to the ground. "Useless." I take a deep breath. The smell in there always makes me sick. It does, too, that smell of old meat and cheap oil and garlic. The clouds on the horizon are slowly taking over the sky, turning everything gray and blurry. "Tell me about it." Lindsay puts a hand on her stomach. "You know what I need?" "A jumbo cup of the country's best yogurt," I say, smiling. TCBY is another thing we can't bring ourselves to abbreviate. "Definitely a jumbo cup of the country's best yogurt," Lindsay echoes. Even though we're both freezing, we order double chocolate soft serve with sprinkles and crushed peanut butter cups on top, which we eat on our way back to school, blowing on our fingers to keep them warm. Alex and Anna are gone from Hunan Kitchen when we pass, but we run into them again at the smoker's lounge.
We have exactly 7 minutes left until the bell for eighth period, and Lindsay pulls me behind the tennis courts so she can have a cigarette without listening to Alex and Anna argue. That's what it looks like they're doing, anyway. Anna's head is bent, and Alex is grabbing her shoulders, whispering to her. The cigarette in his hand burns so close to her dull brown hair, I'm positive it's going to catch on fire, and I picture her whole head just going up like that, like a match. Lindsay finishes her smoke, and we dump our yogurt cups right there on top of the frozen black leaves and trampled cigarette packs and plastic bags half filled with rainwater. I'm feeling anxious about tonight. Half dread and half excitement. Like when you hear thunder and know that any second you'll see lightning tearing across the sky, nipping at the clouds with its teeth. I shouldn't have skipped out on English. It's given me too much time to think. And thinking never did anybody any good, no matter what your teachers and parents and the science club freaks tell you. We skirt the perimeter of the tennis courts and go up along Senior Alley. Alex and Anna are still standing half-concealed behind the gym. Alex is on his second cigarette, at least. Definitely an argument. I feel a momentary rush of satisfaction. Rob and I hardly ever fight. At least not about anything serious. That must mean something. Trouble in paradise, I say.
More like trouble in the trailer park, Lindsay says.
We start cutting across the teacher's lot when we see Ms. Winters, the vice principal, threading between cars, trying to root out the smokers who don't have time or are too lazy to walk all the way down to the lounge and instead try to hide out between the teacher's old Volvos and Chevrolets. Ms. Winters has some crazy vendetta against people who smoke. I heard that her mom died of lung cancer or emphysema or something. If you get caught smoking by Ms. Winters, you get 3 Friday detentions. No questions asked. Lindsay frantically rifles in her bag for her trident and pops 2 pieces in her mouth. Shit, shit. You can't get busted just for smelling like smoke, I say, even though Lindsay knows this. She likes the drama, though. Funny how you can know your friends so well, but you still end up playing the same games with them. She ignores me. How's my breath? She breathes on me. Like a friggin' menthol factory. Ms. Winters hasn't spotted us yet. She's making her way down the rows, sometimes stooping to peer underneath the cars as though someone might be sandwiched against the ground trying to light up. There's a reason everyone calls her the nicotine Nazi behind her back. I hesitate, looking back toward the gym. I don't especially like Alex, and I don't like Anna, but anyone who's ever been through high school understands you have to stick together against the parents, teachers, and cops. It's one of those invisible lines, us against them. You just know this. Like you know where to sit and who to talk to and what to eat in the cafeteria, without even knowing how you know, if that makes sense. Should we go back and warn them? I ask Lindsay, and she pauses too, and squints at the skyline like she's thinking about it. Screw it, she says finally. They can take care of themselves. As if to reinforce her point, the bell for final period rings and she gives me a shove. Come on. She's right, as usual. After all, it's not like they've ever done anything for me. Friendship. A history. Lindsay and I became friends in 7th grade. Lindsay picked me out. I'm still not sure why. After years of trying, I had only just clawed my way up from the social bottom to the social middle. Lindsay's been popular since 1st grade when she moved here. In the class circus that year, she was the ringleader. When we did a production of The Wizard of Oz the next year, she was Dorothy. And in 3rd grade, when we all performed Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, she got to play Charlie. I think that pretty much gives you an idea. She's the kind of person who makes you feel drunk just by being around her, like suddenly the world's edges are dulled and all of the colors are spinning together. I've never told her that, obviously. She'd make fun of me for lezzing out on her. Anyway, the summer before 7th grade, a bunch of us were at Tara Flute's pool party. Beth Schiff was showing off by doing cannonballs in the deep end, but really, she was showing off the fact that between May and July, she'd sprouted a pair of C-cup boobs, definitely the biggest of any girl there. I was in the house getting a soda when all of a sudden Lindsay came up to me, eyes shining. She'd never spoken to me before. "You've got to come see this," she said, grabbing my arm. Her breath smelled like ice cream. She pulled me into Tara's room where all the girls had piled their bags and their changes of clothes. Beth's bag was pink and had her initials marked in purple embroidery on the side. Lindsay had obviously gone through it because she immediately crouched down and reached for a clear zipper case, like the kind we had to store pens in when we were in grade school. "Look." She held it up, rattling it. Inside were two tampons. I don't remember how it started, but suddenly Lindsay and I were running through the house, checking bathroom cabinets and drawers, gathering up all the tampons and pads that Tara's mother and older sister had in the house. I was so happy, I was dizzy. Lindsay Edgecombe and I were talking, and not just talking, but laughing, and not just laughing, but laughing so hard I had to squeeze my legs together to keep from peeing. Then we ran out onto the deck and started throwing handful after handful of tampons down onto the pool party below. Lindsay was screaming, "Beth, these fell out of your bag!" Some of the tampons swirled down into the water, and all the guys were suddenly pushing and shoving to get out of the pool like they were going to be contaminated. Beth stood on the diving board, dripping wet and shaking, while the rest of us nearly died laughing. It reminded me of the time my parents took me to the Grand Canyon in fourth grade and made me stand on a ledge to get photographed. My legs hadn't been able to stop shaking, and my feet got a tingling feeling in the soles, like they were itching to jump. I couldn't stop thinking about how easy it would be to fall, how high up we were. After my mom took the picture and let me back away from the ledge, I started laughing and couldn't stop. Standing on the deck with Lindsay, I got that exact same feeling. After that, Lindsay and I were best friends. Allie came in later after she and Lindsay were in a field hockey league together the summer before eighth grade. Elodie moved to Ridgeview freshman year. At one of the first parties of the year, she hooked up with Sean Morton, who Lindsay had had a crush on for 6 months. Everyone thought Lindsay would kill Elodie. But the next Monday at school, Elodie was at our lunch table, and she and Lindsay were bent over a plate of curly fries, giggling and acting like they'd known each other forever. I'm glad. Even though Elodie can sometimes be embarrassing, I think deep down, she's the nicest of any of us.